We're going to be speaking to Nick Hancock, who broke a record for living on rock all off the Donegal coast. Good morning, Nick Hancock.
Hi.
Lovely to speak with you. Now, Rockall, it's an islet, I suppose you could describe it. It's off the Donegal coast, also off the Scottish coast, I suppose you could also argue. Tell us a little bit about Rockall, as much as you know, Nick. Well, not as much as time will permit that you know.
calling it an island or an islet is probably quite grand. It's essentially just a large piece of rock, about 250 miles off the Outer Hebrides, and there's very little life on there. There's obviously seabirds and some minke whale around it, but no plant life to speak of. Not very big. It's about 18 metres high by about 25 at its widest.
And on the surface of it, how much space do you have, and is it flat or is it undulating or...?
The summit's flat. The top was blown off to put a light beacon on there. So it's fairly flat up there, but it's not very long. It's about 8 foot long, that piece. And then there's a ledge about 3 metres below the summit, which is uneven and not horizontal. But that's about 11 foot by about 4 foot. The rest of the rock is fairly steep.
There has been some controversy in the past, hasn't there, as to who actually has ownership of this. Where are we at that stage?
It's disputed territory. My understanding is that it's currently British, but the UN are considering various claims from Ireland, the Faroe Islands and Iceland. So at some point they'll make a formal decision on that.
And I presume, look, I mean, it's a rock sticking out of the sea. I presume this is more to do with... the surrounding sea waters and perhaps the resources contained there within.
Yeah, I think historically it was to do with territory and the potential for spying on missile tests from Benbecula, but now it's all about potential mineral resources out beyond Rockall.
Do you know why it's there? And I mean, I know it's a natural phenomenon, but it's just it's just a rock sticking out of the sea randomly. I presume, was it volcanic activity or?
Yeah, it's granite, and I think the current understanding is that it's a volcanic plug from an extinct volcano.
Really quite bizarre. So anyway, you decided that you were going to go and live there. What possessed you to do that? I mean, you're an adventurer, but is it that adventurous?
Yeah, I mean, I think I was looking for a big challenge. I've climbed quite a few big mountains and run marathons and ultra marathons, and wanted some sort of expedition where potentially there were some records that could be broken. And I was looking at some sort of sea kayaking expedition out to St Kilda, and in the process of researching that, actually came across Rockall and its history, and the place just kind of grabbed me. So I was, that's how I got involved.
What was the greatest challenge in the amount of time you spent there?
The biggest challenge on the rock was probably weathering a storm I had on overnight on the 1st of July, where I had force 9 gales, and the sea state was really high. And I, my shelter, my pod was up on the ledge that I talked about before, which was probably about 14, 15 metres above sea level, but I still got hit by waves and the pod moved. It was in the middle of the night, so it was dark. So it was a really scary time.
Horrible. Did you have to physically anchor yourself at any point? You know, because, I mean, it wouldn't be hard for a human to be displaced off the top of it, I imagine.
No, I mean, the rock's quite coarse, so it's fairly grippy, but when it gets wet, all the guano that's on there from the seabirds is really slippy. So if I was outside my shelter, I had a climbing harness on and a lifeline, and I was clipped into various fixings around the rock as I was moving around.
In that storm, did you lose any supplies, any equipment?
Yeah, I lost 4 barrels of kit and food. So my original plan was to be there for 60 days, around 2 months, and actually had to come off at 45 days because of a combination of losing that food and also when my boat was available to come and get me.
And how did you pass the time?
I tried to sleep as much as possible.
That's what we do here. That's what I try and do in the mainland. Did you do anything different?
early evenings and late mornings, just to try and eat into the time, and then during the waking hours, I just had various tasks to complete. I did a lot of reading on e-books, but also when I could get out of the pod, when weather allowed, I did a lot of recording of the features and surveyed the ledge and the summit, collected rock samples for St. Andrews University and took some magnetism readings for them. Lots of little things like that.
Did you get anything out of this other than achieving a personal challenge?
It's a personal challenge. I broke both the occupation records, which were a solo record of 40 days and a group record of 42 days. And I also raised so far about just over £8,000 for Help for Heroes as well.
Mm. And were you in communication throughout the course of the challenge?
Yeah, I had a satellite phone, a handheld unit from Wireless Innovation, which was good for just talking to the Coast Guard, for example, after the storm, just to get updates on the weather. And then I also had an Inmarsat BGAN unit, which enabled me to access the internet, which meant I could get really up-to-date forecasts and answer emails and tweet to keep people up-to-date with what I was doing.
Brilliant. And did you leave any flags behind you that we're going to have to sail out there and replace? No.
Any flags? No. I left some bolts in the rock where I'd been attached, and that's pretty much it.
And this is a one-time trick, is it? I mean, what's your next challenge, or do you have a next challenge planned out at this point?
Nothing planned. I've got a few sort of embryonic ideas, but the sort of immediate task is getting back to normal life and then back to work next week. And then we'll see whether any more adventures are on the horizon. I might have to have a conversation with my wife about that first.
Okay. Indeed. Well, every a great adventurer, be it man or woman, requires a great deal of support from their partner there's a lot to it. Listen, it's been a pleasure speaking to you, Nick. Thanks so much for coming on the programme.
Thank you.
Okay, that's Nick Hancock, who broke the record for living on Rock Hall. If you haven't seen Rock Hall and you have access to a computer, you should Google it. It's quite a bizarre-looking jot up out of the sea. And you may remember former MEP Pat the Cope Gallagher. He once complained that Rock Hall was in his constituency. Now, clearly it wasn't to garnish any votes, as there are none available, but there you go. 086 77 00 555 is the text line. Thank you for those of you who are texting in. You can call us to 074 91 25000. We were asking what we could do to get more tourists to Ireland during the week. It emerged that Donegal, the fifth most popular tourism destination for staycation, and that's the buzzword, isn't it, for people who are holidaying within Ireland. Kerry, the Kingdom, it came out on top, probably not a great surprise, and fifth isn't bad, but it was only 7% of people would choose Donegal, whereas Kerry was up in the 20s or 30s. So sometimes the statistics can belie the actual numbers. Well, this caller says, to get more tourists to Donegal, we have to have reasonably priced entertainment for families. Theme parks, roller rinks, swimming pools, ice rinks, zoos, tennis courts, cycling tracks. We live in a lovely county, but roads too dangerous now for children to cycle without supervision. Beach is lovely for a day. Our children have been reared by the beach, weather permitting, that is. Well, hopefully your children got down to the beach over the last couple of days. But those are the challenges in how do you attract more people to Donegal, because everyone's saying that, you know, it's going to be one of our growth industries. And if there is a 2-3 tier economic recovery, that you know, we can perhaps maximise our potentials through tourism. We also were asking people out in the streets about Letterkenny, a new town manager looking to revitalise the old Main Street, the traditional Main Street, I suppose you could call it. Texter says, the plan of Letterkenny is ridiculous. It's like the three different parts to it. You've no choice but to drive to each part. It would be much easier to be able to walk to each stopping location when this might help the traffic. It's just another headache. It's an interesting comment, and it is one that has been raised going back years at Letterkenny Town Council meetings I attended, where people are suggesting that, perhaps better access between the various areas, the old town, the old Main Street, and what some people are calling the new Main Street, and other areas of the town. Keep them coming. 086 77 00 555. I was driving up to work today in the dark weather because of the overheaded clouds, and it astonishes me how many people still will not switch on their lights. People overtaking in black cars with a black background, you can't see anything. It annoys
me, but what annoys you? Is there something that you want to get off your chest today that annoys you? Well, if it'll help to share, you know, sharing is half the battle. If there's something particularly annoys you, text 086-77-00-555. A problem shared is a problem halved. And call us on to an 0749125000. We're going to be going to Derry. Another great event up there. The Flavours of the Foil Festival. We're going to have a brief chat with Brian McDermott, the No Salt Chef, to see how things are panning out there. We're going to take a piece of music and ad, and then we'll be right back. Stay tuned. It's the Weekend Edition with Greg Hughes. Now, you're very welcome back to the programme. Coming up on the programme, we're going to be speaking to Tommy McCafferty from Donegal. He's a mixed martial artist. He's just signed a big deal with a major promotion, and the MMA stock's never been higher in this country. Of course, there's a massive event took place recently down in Dublin, a UFC-involved event, and we'll hear how Tommy's getting on and what his aspirations are. That's all to come. But now we're joined on the programme by the No Salt Chef, Brian McDermott. Brian, where's me food? Why aren't you here?
Good morning, Craig, and welcome to a very, very vibrant Guildhall Square here.
Ah, you're in Derry. Very, very
good. We are, and I'll tell you, there's absolutely no shortage of food here this morning. Just as I talked to you, there is about 14 species of fish passing me by to be set up here this morning as well.
And it's the Flavours of the Foil Festival in Derry, isn't it? Tell us a little bit about it, Brian.
Yeah, it's the flavours of the foil, which is a celebration, really, of the seafood and what we have here. And I suppose, Greg, in one sense, you know, we turn our backs on seafood, we turn our backs on the river and on the foil, and it really has some of the best produce in Europe. And I would honestly say that, in Europe. So the idea behind this festival was we set it up 4 years ago. So it's now in its fourth year, and it attracted somewhere in the region of about 14,000 people last year over 2 days. And again, you have 14 chefs here from restaurants right across the Northwest, and they're actually cooking live their signature dishes and having it for sale at a reduced price. So come along, meet the chefs from your favourite restaurants, and also a live cookery theatre that's operating here throughout the 2 days, with again some top name chefs appearing here in the Northwest again.
Sounds fantastic. And what, people can just turn up, is there a charge for it? It runs today and tomorrow, isn't it, Brian?
It's 2 days. It kicks off at 12 o'clock today and again at 12 o'clock tomorrow. And the beauty about this is there's absolutely no charge.
No.
It's free and there's loads for the kids to do as well. And I mean, the great thing here, Greg, is come along and actually see whole fish, see it being filleted, see it being cooked, taste your way around the marquee and really just enjoy what is our own local Providence food, seafood.
Sounds fantastic, Brian. We're a bit short on time. We'll be chatting to you again in the future, hopefully. Best of luck with that. Kicks off at 12. I know loads of people are going. It's going to be a huge event, isn't it? And another feather in the cap of Derry.
Absolutely. This is another huge stamp to say that we're going to start shouting about our seafood across the Northwest.
Superb. Brian, thank you so much. Brian McDermott there, the Noel Schultz chef. Noel Schultz chef, talking to us there live from the Flavours of the Foil in Derry, running the 26th today, tomorrow, I can't believe it's the 26th of July, 27th, and the Guildhall Square is where those demonstrations, or people demonstrating food, is taking place. So imagine there's going to be huge buzz about that. I know the food festival in Letterkenny proved a huge success, and Donegal Towns is coming up shortly, and I believe there's one in Inishowen as well. 086 77 00 555, if I've got any of that wrong. You can call us on 074 91 25000. I was talking about what annoys you out there, and this is a good one. I didn't realise how much annoyed me. Selfies. This texter says, you know what annoys me, Greg? Anyone who takes a selfie with a surprised look on their face. That makes no sense. And they say, good show, by the way. Thanks very much. I believe no one has arms long enough to take a selfie. You need at least 7 foot arms to take a selfie that is going to do you any favours whatsoever. So what annoys you? Keep them coming. 086 77 00 555. No Garth Brooks concerts seems to annoy another listener there. What a joke we are in the eyes of the world. Croker should be wedged, shouldn't it? But nothing. Nothing there at all. Keep them coming to us. 086 77 00 555. You can call us too, and 074 91 25000. Your requests more than welcome on the programme as well, so keep them coming. For James and Joanne Doherty, they're getting married today. Congratulations to both of you. The message comes in from Madge Bell. For Dermot McCafferty and Shauna Watson, who are getting married today, from John and Barbara, best of luck to you. Drew Stewart and Phyllis Dill getting married today in Rosnakill. Joanne and Sean and all the family in Ganala saying hello to you. Laura and Declan McFadden, who are married this week, looking forward to seeing you today. They're getting married or were married. Maybe there's a little after party going on. George and Jacqueline at the Glebe and Letterkenny are going in any case. Laura and Declan McFadden, again for you, looking forward to celebrating your wedding. This time Mark and Barbara and Stephen are saying, sending along their good wishes. Shauna Watson and Dermot getting married today. Friends Rachel and Rosie in Raphoe send all their love to you. Charlene Britton and Declan Barnett, they're getting married today. Charlotte, your mum, dad and brothers and sisters have been on to Highland Radio to wish you all the very best, and we wish you so too, of course. Kira Focker in Tully Gay, happy second birthday coming into you from all the family. Hi, Kira. I hope you're listening. Perhaps the youngest listener to the show, but it's great to have you listening nonetheless, and hopefully you'll be here for many years to come. 086 77 00 555 is the text line. 074 91 25000. Many of you texting and calling in with what annoys you. Keep them coming. You're very, very welcome back to the weekend edition here in Highland with Greg Hughes. John Paul Boyle, good morning.
Good morning, Greg. How are you?
Lovely to speak to you, John. Thank you very much for coming on. Is it John Paul or John?
It's John Paul.
John Paul's the full title. Okay. John, tell us a little bit about your story. We're going to be talking about your company, UPilot, but this was not what you set out to do, was it not? I mean, initially you were made redundant. Is that fair to say?
Oh, that's correct. Basically, my background was I was working in construction, and I was sort of doing some flying lessons while I was working here in Dublin, and trying to get the money together to get my pilot's license. Mm. And then sort of the recession hit, and I ended up back in Donegal, sort of around 2008.
Now, you were at a fork, effectively, because you could go one way, whereas, you know, you could sit and feel sorry for yourself, but there was another road that you could take, and that's the one you did take.
Yeah, so essentially, I decided, first of all, to sort of look at a career change, and at the time, I was thinking, well, I can't really afford to do any flying lessons, so I started looking at building a small flight simulator at home to sort of keep myself in the game. And then I also considered sort of going into IT. So I went back to college through the back to work program with and went into LYIT. And while I was there, I started looking at the idea of making a business out of the flight simulator, you know.
Mm.
And I got together with a colleague of mine, Kevin, and we sort of came up with an idea where we would develop a sort of a full-scale one-to-one Boeing 737-800 flight simulator.
And would this be a case of actually, and pardon my ignorance, buying one in and setting it up, or do you have to develop yourself, or what was the situation in terms of getting the simulator up and running?
Yeah, well, basically, if you wanted to buy one, there's a couple of companies around the world that make them, but you're looking at upwards of €250,000 for one of these. So we decided to look at, you know, constructing one ourselves. So looked at, we sort of contacted different suppliers and looking at where we could pick up second-hand aircraft parts, and we put a plan together to sort of build one ourselves for a much, much cheaper cost than it was to buy one, you know.
But you'd just been made redundant. You know, obviously it's not €250,000, but I presume there was a cost involved. Were you able to sort of fall back on your own resources, or was there a challenge in financing this idea?
Yeah. Well, I suppose if we go back a bit to the start, we essentially started out with a small simulator that we built ourselves. So we constructed it out of basic, you know, wood and painted it, and sort of, it was like a little, you know, single seat version of the one we currently have. And it was from that we thought, well, look, let's try and scale it up. So we were kind of looking at how we would maybe be able to afford to fund something like this. And so we started contacting the likes of the Donegal Local Development Company and Uthris na Gaeltacht and sort of looking to see what sort of supports were out there for startup businesses, you know.
Mm.
And it's from there that we actually started to sort of gather together the fund. And we also got a loan from the AIB Bank and went ahead and started developing it, you know.
Was it a big decision? I mean, we can all have high ideas and we can have the best faith in the world in them, but you never truly know. And you kind of sometimes can be putting all your eggs in one basket. Were you committed to this from the get-go, or did you wobble at all in thinking, really, do we want to be sort of investing this heavily, getting this, you know, getting so involved in something?
Yeah, well, it was a bit of both. To be honest, we were sort of, you see, it's sort of an idea that evolved. We didn't start out with the plans of having a full-scale simulator like we have today. Mm. It sort of started small. We looked at the one we had and we thought, well, let's try and sort of enhance this one and maybe use this one to take it to schools and get transition year students interested in careers in aviation and this type of thing. So it was an idea that evolved, and we started thinking, look, there's corporate events companies that might make use of this. And the more we looked at it, the more we thought, well, look, if we really want to get into this properly, we really need to have a good product. And it wasn't that we woke up one morning and said, let's go and get a loan out and sort of try and develop this, you know, full simulator.
But I presume you knew, from what you're saying, you knew you'd hit on something from an early stage too that could grow.
Oh, of course, yeah. We knew from the get-go that we had something good in the old simulator, and we thought, well, we can really, you know, make a good business here if we can develop, you know, a one-to-one scale one. So, I mean, Kevin's background was audio visuals. He used to work in the UK, and he sort of came up with a visual system that we could implement, and that's one of the big costs as well in building the simulators, trying to get the, you know, the view out the windows, a synthetic view created that looks realistic.
And do you have to then sort of, you know, once you've produced the piece of equipment, I presume, because, you know, if it's a simulator and say for a pilot or someone who wants to become a pilot, it has to represent exactly what they would experience. So does that have to be certified? Is there an overseeing body in that area?
There would be, yeah. In terms of flight simulation in Europe, there's two main categories of flight simulators. You have level D full flight simulators. Those are the type of one that costs like upwards of €10 to €20 million.
Yeah.
And pilots can step into them and do all their training on that aircraft, having never flown the actual real one, and still go out with a fully qualified license. Then you have another category of flight simulators which are fixed base. So in other words, they're not on a hydraulic platform. And those are called procedural trainers. And that's the type that we have. So in terms of certification, you can go for sort of fixed-based procedural training certification, or you can step it up a step further. Ours, we haven't had ours certified at the moment. Basically, our market at the moment is sort of giving people flight experiences.
Yeah.
So at the moment, we don't require it to have it certified.
And do you have the one that you have now, the latest one, or you're manufacturing them for sale? You know, what would be the revenue stream there?
Yeah, well, what we're doing at the moment, the latest one we built, which is the full-scale 737-800, it's the same type as Boeing, or same type as Ryanair would operate.
Mm-hmm.
That's currently located in Dublin Airport in Terminal 2, and it's open to passengers to come in and experience what it's like to fly a jet.
Wow.
So that's where our revenue's coming from at the moment. But we're also looking at sort of developing simulators for other companies. So if someone wants to come in like an entertainment company, then we develop them as well, you know.
And they move and jerk and all that type of thing, do they, or...?
No, not this particular model. This one is fixed base.
Right.
So you get motion cueing through the visuals. So when you get in, you're in an enclosed cockpit, and when you look out the window, the environment is moving, so it gives
and
you
a sensation. And that creates the sense,
movement.
Yeah, it plays with the mind a little bit. Sounds absolutely fantastic, and it's onwards and upwards. You hinted at it there. Where do you see the business growing into the future?
Well, to be honest, we don't really know exactly what direction this company will end up taking us in now. I mean, if we get a few solid orders in for flight simulators, that will certainly keep us busy for the next year or two. Whereas we have this one located here, and we have a guaranteed revenue stream coming in from this one. So we may look at expanding into a couple of the different locations in Europe, you know.
Mm. So just remind us where this is based so people can get that experience.
Yeah, so it's located in the mezzanine level on T2 in Dublin Airport. So after security, when you arrive into the departure lounge, you got some time to kill before you get on your flight. You can look around and you'll see the signs for us.
Sounds absolutely brilliant. A big hello to John Paul and Kevin, a new pilot from at U Pilot from all the family in Buncrana coming in for you, John Paul.
That would be Bonaman, I would say.
Bonaman. Yeah, it is Bonaman. Well, at least we've got the right family. We know that for a fact. I'm so used to reading Buncrana. But listen, fantastic. It's a great news story and an inspiration too. And we wish you the best of luck. And we hope it just continues to go from strength to strength. And always great to hear one of our own doing so well. And thanks so much for coming on, John Paul.
Well, thanks for having us on, Greg.
It's an absolute pleasure. John Paul Boyle there of U Pilot, and my apologies to John Paul's family, Bonaman. I'll get it right in the end. There you go. Rightio, people who take selfies should take a long, hard look at themselves. The selfie issue is growing here. We've had about three or four at this stage against people who take selfies, just don't like them. If you agree, 086 77 00 555. What time does the food festival in Derry finish at? It's 6 o'clock each day. More than happy to pass that information on. 6 o'clock today, it finishes at, starts at noon, and the same time tomorrow from 12 noon until 6. And what annoys me most, property owners and some farmers who won't cut back their hedges and wild growth on bad corners of roads that obstruct our vision. That is an annoyance and really dangerous too. And I know precisely what you're talking about. I could point out a few areas where you see that. And there is that safety aspect as well as the annoyances there as well. And then another one here, them stupid chippings the council put on the road annoy the hell out of me. I know exactly what you're talking about, Mick, as well. I'm on the same wavelength here. Keep those texts coming, 086 77 00 555 074 91 25000. On a more serious note, a caller says, if the Republic is so against what's happening in Gaza, why do they not get involved? Ireland, at its best, complain and do nothing about it. And that's a debate I've had with people before. And, you know, if you do sort of campaign on an issue from your computer screen, and I'm not saying there's anything wrong with it, is it making any material difference? And the argument being put to me is that, well, of course it does, because, you know, if enough people are active on something, either, you know, in a physical way or even by the stroke of a keyboard keys, it can make a difference. And that's the argument that people make. Okay, just a reminder for you that P.O. McCann's coming up from 12. He's live from OMA. Hopefully have a wee chat with him before now and 12 to see what's coming up in the programme. I'm a little bit behind on breaks. We'll be back with more after this. Okay, you're welcome back to the programme. This caller says, I don't have anything against selfies except when people stick their tongues out. It's so annoying. Well, that's Miley Cyrus's trick, isn't it? Sticking the tongue out. I think they belong very much
in the mouth. Being at a checkout and the assistant's talking to another colleague or customer and ignoring you, it happens. It's so unmannerly. Yeah, that does annoy also. For Joseph McGee and Kathleen O'Donnell, who are getting married in Rome today, I hope you have the Highland Radio app downloaded, Josephine and Kathleen, and you are listening to us in that beautiful city. This request comes in from mum, dad and family. Diane Gallagher in Killigordon, happy birthday, coming in from Granny and all the family there. Could you wish my husband Mark McCready from Newtown Cunningham a happy birthday? This comes in from your wife Carol and three boys, Kyle, Tyler and Connor. And last one for now, request for Mark and Roisin on your wedding day. Love and best wishes from Jacqueline, Jared and David. I hope they got the names there correct. 086 77 00 555. Okay, now for something completely different on the programme, we're going to be discussing mixed martial arts with Donegal professional mixed martial arts specialist Tommy McCafferty, who's just signed a lucrative deal with a major promotion in a time where Irish sports fans just can't get enough of this sport. Tommy, thanks so much for taking the call.
No bother at all, Greg.
Tommy, I think many people perhaps would have had their first taste of mixed martial arts with that hugely successful UFC event in Dublin last week. It's those type of events that can help boost the profile of the sport. Would you agree?
Yeah, definitely. The media coverage was sensational for the event. Everywhere you looked, people were chatting about it. It was actually great to see. It was actually portrayed in a really good light for a change.
But this isn't your first dance, Tommy. You've been a mixed martial artist for some time now, haven't you?
Yeah, I took my first professional fight in 2007. And then I had stepped over to the kickboxing for a while, and I came back then in 2012. And I've been full-time at it ever since.
It's a tough discipline. What got you involved?
I think it was just kind of the challenge of the competition. It definitely is. Martial arts fight is definitely the main one. You know, it's a mixture of everything, so it's I think it's the biggest challenge. And anybody's in the sport and the competition, you're always looking for that challenge.
And tell us about this new deal. Who have you signed with?
I signed with Cage Warriors. At the moment, they're the leading promotion in Europe, and they're definitely it's the main feeder show for the likes of UFC, the likes of Conor McGregor and Cal Pendred, Neil Siri, all the boys that actually fought in the UFC at the weekend. But I actually won the Cage Warriors titles before they signed.
And I think, too, you know, it's Dana White, isn't it, is the UFC boss. He's going to be noticing these Irish guys making a wave. So if you can, you know, really stand out with Cage Warriors, I mean, there is that path there for you to really, really hit the big time.
Yeah, the way things are going at the moment, the Irish guys are really pushing forward and they're starting to really open the doors for everyone else. And I think it's just a matter of time before Ireland really starts to explode on the international scene in an even bigger way than they have last weekend.
So what's your schedule now with Cage Warriors?
I'm scheduled to fight now on the 16th of August in the Helix in Dublin. That'll be my first fight. I've actually signed for 5 fights exclusively. So this is the first fight now on the 16th of August.
Now you're 5-0, aren't you, since you came back into the sport, giving it your full dedication. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I am 5-0, 5 finishes. I've went to the second round once. I think it was 2 months into the same round, but every other fight has been a first-round finish.
And what stands out in your style? Are you a stand-up specialist, or do you get down on the ground, or what?
Well, to be honest, now everyone knows I come from the striking background with the kickboxing and the Thai boxing, but all my fights so far has actually finished on the ground.
That must be good for you because, you know, as you say, maybe you are pigeonholed as a stand-up fighter, but you're proving yourself that you can mix it up, you know, you can change up your style, and you need to be able to do that, don't you?
Yeah, well, at the moment I'm putting on between 20 and 25 hours every week of actual training for it, and a lot of it's concentrated on the wrestling side of things and on the actual ground side of things as well, so I'm really trying to round out my game. I don't want to get to a certain level and then be exposed as being just a stand-up fighter or just, you know, one-dimensional.
Yeah, and I know you're fully committed to your current contract, but as you have mentioned, there is that path to what would be seen as the premier, the UFC, the worldwide recognized promotion. And, you know, if you manage to get involved there, the options could be, well, the sky could be the limit because, as I say, it's a massive industry in America particularly, isn't it?
Yeah, at the moment, I think it's still the fastest growing sport in the world. And I guess it's really, really only going to get bigger. They're running more and more shows all the time, which means the roster of fighters is getting bigger and bigger. The opportunities is getting bigger. And the actual sponsorship deals, the media, everything seems to be really starting to explode up the way now.
I'm a big boxing fan myself, and, you know, it seems incredibly controlled. And initially, when I started watching MMA, I thought, well, that control isn't there. But that's not really the case, is it? I mean, it does seem far more aggressive, but the fighter's health remains the priority, doesn't it?
People don't seem to realize the actual mixed martial arts is actually a lot safer than boxing. Like, statistics since 1996, I think it is, there's been 97 deaths in boxing, and there's been only one in mixed martial arts. So when you compare the statistics, that's extremely safe compared to the likes of boxing. And I guess mostly down to boxing having a standing 8 count or a standing 10 count. You know, that seems to be the biggest issue. Because in the boxing, if you get dropped and you might have a flash knockdown, you'll get back up and you'll be given your 10 seconds to recover and you'll let go again. If the mixed martial arts, if you go down, the referee will finish it. You know, if he thinks you're done, you're done. Mm. You won't get your second chance and maybe you end up with a concussion or whatever else.
Well, Tommy, you're 28 now. That would be seen as coming into your prime in this sport, would it?
Yeah, to be honest, I think I'm only really starting to hit my prime now.
Yeah,
I've been training full time as a professional martial artist now since towards the end of 2006, and I feel like I'm only really starting to come together now. Like the mental aspect, the physical aspect, really know how to diet, how to make weight properly. Everything's really starting to click properly now.
And I'd say, you know, when a group like the Cage Warrior Fighting Championship come on board and recognise your abilities, that's perhaps that, you know, final incentive that you need to ensure that you do everything right and put all the time in.
I'm always trying to be as professional as I can. Like, I've always put on the time, I've always tried to diet. At the moment, even at the moment, I'm travelling to Belfast twice a week for training, on top of my normal training in Letterkenny and Derry. So I don't mind putting on the miles. I've travelled this year alone. I've travelled to Paul Daly over in England. Paul's actually signed for K1 in Bellator there last week. I've been to Brazil for a month last March, and I'm planning to go again towards the end of this year.
Well, you know, Tommy McCaffrey, look, we congratulate you on this new deal, and we look forward to following your progress, should I say, and it's onwards and upwards.
Thanks very much. Looking forward to hopefully doing Donegal proud again.
Superb. Tommy McCaffrey, thank you so much.
No problem at all. Thank you for having me.
During the week, I managed to catch up with Jared Grant. He's the head of IT at Primerica. Now, Primerica was voted in the top 25 greatest places to work in Europe. And I asked Jared why.
What we do here, Greg, is we're an offshore technology and shared services center for Prudential. So we develop software, we also test that software, and we also have a number of operations functions and professional services who do end-user customer support, transaction and financial transactions for Prudential, and a number of what we call specialist services, which would be actuarial and legal as well.
What makes it such a great place to work then?
I suppose there's no one standout thing, and it's a really great question because, I mean, when you look at employee satisfaction, obviously there's, you know, a recognition of quality, competitive, total compensation, a great working environment in terms of the overall quality of the campus, the technology, a subsidized canteen. It's really about employees feeling that they have a lot of ownership about the overall running of the company and how their role is part of, you know, a greater mission in terms of their connection to the overall mission of the company.
And I don't want to be crude in the question, but many people will judge their satisfaction in the workplace by how much they got paid. Is it Primerica's philosophy that it has to be multi-layered also?
Well, I think pay is one element of it, but when you think about, you know, what people, in terms of coming to work for, you know, a total of one-third of their day, it's a lot more than just pay. And, you know, there is a good work environment, and we also encourage a lot of activities outside work, which give people a lot of meaning to their jobs in terms of corporate social responsibility and volunteerism. And the other one I think is really, really important is that, you know, we have a real strength in innovation here, and we're always looking at a body or work or a challenge and thinking how we can make it better, and not just in the technological space, but also in process and organizational management. So we challenge employees. And over the last 2 years, we've made a really concerted effort to tie our overall rewards program, you know, to innovations, incentivizing staff to come up with innovative ideas that can be shared across the company, and then working with people to bring those ideas to life for customers. So that's really important to staff as well.
Primerica, I seem to recall, was included in a recent map that was released as it relates to, you know, what companies give back to the local community, and volunteerism was also mentioned within that. What is the philosophy there, and how do you get workers to buy into that? Because I presume some of this would be done in their own time.
Yes, and in fact, it's fair to say, Greg, that the majority of it would be done in their own time. Last year, the staff here in Letterkenny contributed around 7,000 hours of time, you know, to various different organisations, from the Special Olympics to the Letterkenny Coder Dojo, and many clubs and organisations around the county. We are very much, we encourage it. We have a sort of a catalyst event every year called Global Volunteer Day, which is the first Saturday every October, which really invites employees to come up with projects to give back to the communities that they work and live in, and then we help them organize those projects, and then there's grants available at the end of those projects to some of those clubs and organizations in terms of, you know, bodies of work around pitches, around training, around going out into the community and doing a cleanup. So it's very much, you know, working with employees to understand what's important to them and have us help them deliver that in their local communities.
Now, Primerica is a massive company and, you know, operates across certain time zones. And I understand there is that ability for some people if they wish to perhaps work from home. But can smaller companies, small and medium-sized companies, employ some of the incentives or some of the mechanisms that you use for staff, do you think, and benefit their businesses?
Absolutely. There's no reason why, you know, small to medium enterprises can't adopt some of the practices which we have, you know, really, really pioneered here around alternative working arrangements and flexibility. So we have around 20% of our staff, just over 200, who work from home on a semi-permanent basis. So they're only in the office maybe one day a week or 2 days a month. And that's all over the country. And we have, obviously, the systems and the technology in place to be able to work with those staff collaboratively to make sure that, you know, it's right for the business and it's right for the staff and their work-life balance as well. But there's no reason with the, you know, the increase in investment in broadband and consumer broadband in the regions that, you know, small to medium enterprises, you know, can't take advantage of some of those practices, and many are already.
That's a good point, because obviously you are based in Letterkenny, and the facilities that you talk of are available there. I mean, I suppose if you were to look at it as a county-wide national situation, the sooner we do get that improved infrastructure in terms of, you know, fibre optic broadband and what have you, the better it will be for everyone, and people will be able to benefit like your company has.
Correct. And I think you're seeing an evolution somewhat over the last couple of years, where you are seeing a small gap between the large commercial centres where there is good fibre broadband availability and good technology, as opposed to the rural areas where there, you know, is legacy broadband infrastructure, which could be a mix of mobile or wireless or satellite. And it's really to get everybody on, you know, the same platform if we can, so that, you know, no matter where your home location is, that you have the ability to work for a very large organisation like us and take advantage of everything we have to offer.
And finally, what does the future hold? I mean, there may be people listening that think, you know, it's highly ranked as a great place to work. Maybe I'd like to get in there.
Absolutely.
Are there varying roles as it relates to, you know, what kind of qualifications you would need?
Yes.
Is there a strong tie-in with the local IT, for instance?
I mean, we have a wide range of opportunities on a constant basis within the business. We work with the Letterkenny Institute of Technology to really influence the curriculum around what we need in the technology space for the people that are going to be coming into what we call the systems organization. So that's doing software development, QA testing and engineering. And like that, we have programs with FAS for upskilling and cross-skilling people who maybe want to change career or return into work or as a labor activation measure. And then at the higher end, we're also partnering with Queen's University in Belfast to bring in some of our actuarial talent that we're looking for.
Well, at the very highest level of the likes of programming and other more technical ability, I've heard the criticism that perhaps our courses in this country aren't targeted perhaps specifically enough for certain companies, and I'm not necessarily including Primerica in that, but maybe it is included. Do we need to have an overall look in Ireland, do you think, as to, you know, what courses we're doing and at what level they are being done at?
Yeah, and I think the challenge there is, Greg, that there's always going to be a lag between, you know, what gets into the curriculum of a 3 or 4 year degree and what the industry is looking at a particular point in time. If you look at the very topical subjects right now of maybe digital and social media and the development in engineering around how you engage consumers, that's very, very prevalent right now. It's going to take a little bit of lag time to get that into the curriculums and measure it and put some exams around it. But like companies like us are working with education providers all the time to influence that, and where we can play a role in giving them a little bit of guidance about what we're seeing in the market and what our peers and our competitors and our parent companies are telling us about where they want to go technically, we're always willing to share that. But there will be a natural lag in that respect.
All right, Gerard Grant, Primerica's Vice President of Information Technology. Thanks so much for joining us on the programme this morning.
More than welcome. Thank you.
And that was Gerard Grant, Head of IT at Primerica, speaking to me earlier in the week. That's all we have time for on the programme today. My thanks to Yvonne McFadden, who produced, and each and every one of you who listened, and those who text and called the programme. Have a fantastic day.